Continuing. Scheduled Incarnations, Chapter 7 of Canto 2. And we're going to read Text 13 this evening. Wow. If you were a bird, you could fly. If you're a monkey, you can jump over people. The primeval Lord then assumed the tortoise incarnation in order to serve as a resting place or pivot for the Mundara mountain, which was acting like a churning rod. The demigods and demons were churning the ocean of milk with the Mundara mountain in order to extract nectar. The mountain moved back and forth, scratching the back of Lord Tortoise, who, while partially sleeping, was experiencing an itching sensation. Haribo, haribo. So, this is just one verse, and medium-sized purport, but in the eighth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, there are about six chapters discussing this very wonderful pastime. And the pastime begins with Shukadeva Goswami describing the sequence of manus. So in the Bhagavatam, there's extensive discussion of the reign of Swayambhuva Manu. And by the time we're in the eighth canto, it's just like describing the prominent features of the third Manu, and then the fourth Manu is mentioned, the fifth Manu, and the sixth Manu, Chakshusha Manu. The Manu before this one is Chakshusha Manu. There's mention of the Lord appearing in a suitable form for the churning of the milk ocean by the churning rod of the Mundara mountain. And Maharaj Pariksit says, "Oh, I'd like to hear more about this one. Please describe in detail what form it was that the Lord assumed and what was the pastime that the Lord performed during the reign of Chakshusha Manu." And so, Shukadeva Goswami obliges him by describing in 5-6 chapters this wonderful pastime. So it begins with describing the form of the Lord, who is known as Kurma, who appears also by the name of Ajita. Form of the Lord appears as the son of Vairaja, who is this father, and Deva Sambhuti, who is the mother. And so he's known as Ajita. And this is something, appears to be something similar to Prishnigarbha, who's the son of Prishni and Sutapa, who then takes part in Dhruva Maharaj Leela. So Ajita takes part in this particular Leela. So after describing the appearance of Ajita during the reign of Chakshusha Manu, Shukadeva Goswami then describes two incidents that were particularly harassing the demigods. One of them was that there was a big battle from the side of the demons, and the demons, being very, very powerful, it surged on the kingdom of the demigods, and they beat up on the demigods. They were victorious. And so Indra lost his kingdom. Then Indra, second thing was, Indra was on a journey with the demigods, traveling on a road, riding on an elephant. And while he was traveling on the road, he came across Durvas Muni. And Durvas Muni very generously took one of his own garlands and personally extended the garland to Indra. But Indra is up on this big elephant and Durvas Muni is on the ground, and so Indra's thinking wrongly. He requested his elephant carrier to accept the garland rather than coming down off the elephant and receiving the garland himself and being properly respectful and gracious, because he was proud. So the elephant, receiving the garland, took the garland with his trunk and just underneath his legs threw it onto the ground behind him and trampled on the garland. Just, you know, not mean, just, you know, being an elephant. Durvas Muni was very offended. I curse you, you foolish, prideful Indra. I curse you, you become bereft of all wealth and you become poverty-stricken. No wealth in all three planetary regions. Indra's in big trouble once again. So Indra went to the other demigods. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? They went to Lord Brahma. Oh, Indra, you've done it again. When are you going to learn? You got this problem. You just keep doing foolish things. Anyway, you've come to take shelter, and let us become situated in the quality of goodness, because this is what demigods are supposed to do. And how can we best be situated in the quality of goodness? Take shelter of Lord Vishnu. He's pure goodness. Let us go to the shore of the milk ocean and offer prayers to Lord Vishnu. So they all followed Brahma and they went to Svetadvipa. And there Brahma offered not the Purusha Sukta prayers this time, but standard Vedic prayers, beautiful, beautiful prayers. And Lord Vishnu was so pleased that he appeared before all of them. You know, when he came, he agreed to appear as Krishna, he just replied by sound vibration Brahma could hear, and then he transmitted the message to the others. This time, he personally appeared. Beautiful four-armed form. The demigods were stunned with the beauty of Lord Vishnu. And he gave them very practical, strategic advice this time. His advice was, you've lost your kingdom and you've offended Durvas Muni, so you've lost all your pious credits. So you really don't have much to work with right now. I suggest you do something very prudent and practical. You go to the demigod, go to the demons, and make the following suggestion. You've defeated us. You're the victors. But let's make a truce. Let's see if there's some common interest that we both have. And that common interest is, in fact, Lord Vishnu suggested this, that we take Mundara Mountain to the milk ocean, churn Mundara Mountain, and produce nectar of immortality. Because one who drinks this nectar of immortality becomes immortal. You have nothing to lose. You have everything to gain. What do you say, demons? What do you say, guys? Yeah, great idea. Let's make a truce. The only problem is, Mundara Mountain is really big. And Mundara Mountain is really heavy because it's solid gold. So you're going to help us carry Mundara Mountain to the milk ocean. Sure, let's work together. Teamwork. So they strained and lifted Mundara Mountain. It's so heavy that on the way to the milk ocean, many of both the demons and demigods were crushed, died. Completely understanding the situation, Lord Vishnu, riding on the back of Garuda, standing on the back of Garuda, arrived on the scene and simply glancing over both the demigods and the demons, he brought them back to life. So they were very happy. Then effortlessly, he picked up Mundara Mountain and placed Mundara Mountain on the back of Garuda. Follow me. Let's go to the milk ocean. And they went to the milk ocean together. And he placed Mundara Mountain in the milk ocean. And then with Garuda, he disappeared. Now the demons, very excited, demigods very cooperative. Let's churn the Mundara Mountain. But the problem is Mundara Mountain is still very heavy. And it started sinking and sinking and sinking. What to do? So the Lord, as Kurma avatar, he appeared, lifted Mundara Mountain on his back and indicated, let's have a churning of the milk ocean, but the Mundara Mountain will be the pivot, but we need a churning rope. Vasuki. So then there was this discussion, okay, who's going to hold which end of the rope? And the demons said, we don't want to be near this, the mouth of Vasuki, breathing fire, he might get scorched. We'll take the tail, you take the mouth. Okay, we'll take the mouth. And Vasuki was wrapped around the mountain and the churning back and forth started. So what was the first thing that was produced from the churning of the ocean of milk? Poison. And Vishnu had said, he gave them warnings. The following things are going to happen, and when they happen, don't worry. Just carry out my instructions. So when the poison was produced, it was really intense. Kalakuta is the poison. Deadly poison, and like an ocean, it just started increasing and increasing and increasing and increasing and increasing. What to do? An ocean of ever-increasing poison. There's only one solution. Lord Shiva, he's very merciful. He'll take care of this problem. So Lord Shiva was approached. Lord Shiva, please help. No problem. Oh, and he drew the one swallowing. The whole ocean, and held it in his throat. So his throat became nila, bluish. Some drops of that poison splashed, and in this way, snakes and scorpions and other entities, they became poisonous. drank up the poison and were able to contain the poison. And so then various species of poisonous creatures were created. The demon said, Lord Vishnu said this would happen, but let's keep going. Let's do more churning. Teamwork. So the next thing that was produced Surabhi. The Surabhi cow was produced. And from the milk of the Surabhi cow, so many wonderful milk products were able to be produced. Unlimited supply of milk and milk products. Ghee for sacrificial fire. And so many wonderful things. So they continued their churning. And next, a horse was produced. What's the name of the horse mentioned in Bhagavad Gita? No. What's the name? You don't know. 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. I know that you know. I want to see if someone else knows. Uchaishrava. So Bali, he was the demon in charge of, or he was in charge of the rulership of the demons. So he's the one that the truce was made with, and he thought, I want this horse. This is a grand horse. So he took the horse. Then next, churned from the milk ocean was Airavata. Indra said, I'd like the Airavata. Okay, you take Airavata. Next was the Kastuba gem was generated. They said, this is suitable for Lord Vishnu. Let's give it. It was his plan anyways. We'll give it to him. So the Kastuba gem placed on the chest of Lord Vishnu. And the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi. So it's, we should understand, the commentary explains, it's not that once upon a time Lakshmi didn't exist, and then the churning of the milk ocean, and then Lakshmi existed. But rather, she made her appearance in that way. Same Kastuba gem and so forth. These features of the Supreme Lord are, he makes his appearance as Leela, just like Krishna appearing as the son of Vasudeva and Devaki. It's not that once upon a time Krishna didn't exist. Then Vasudeva and Devaki conceived a son and Krishna was born. But so same, Lakshmi made her appearance in this way. And she took her natural place. No one had to decide what would happen. She took her natural place at the feet of Lord Narayan. Then the plot thickens. The milk ocean also thickens as it was getting churned. Dhanvantari, a partial incarnation of the Supreme Lord, as the bearer of the Lord's knowledge of medicine, personified, brought this knowledge of medicine and also the pot of nectar that they were all waiting for. And right away the demon snatched the pot of nectar and started running.
Wait.
You can't take the pot of nectar. So the demigods went and whined and complained to Lord Vishnu. Hey, wait, what's going on? The demons now have nectar. He said, don't worry. This is all part of the plan. I am going to appear in such a form you have never seen. And so Supreme Lord Vishnu appeared as Mohini Murti. And there's long purports in this section where Prabhupada describes this is the principal enjoyment for demons. More than immortality, the demons want to enjoy the pleasures of associating with the opposite sex. So they were overwhelmed with the beauty of Mohini Murti. And so she... Come on over here, guys. Let's make a plan. So that there isn't any battling between you two, I'll hold the nectar and I'll distribute to all. Okay. And they just turned over the pot of nectar to Mohini Murti. And then she began distributing the pot of nectar to all the demigods. And the demons were thinking, hey, what's going on? So one amongst the demons, he was very clever. His name was Rahu. He sat right in the line in the midst of the demigods. And as Mohini Murti was providing the nectar, he scooped up some of the nectar and started to swallow it. But Mohini Murti could understand, this is not a demigod, this is a demon. And with Sudarshan Chakra, she severed his head from the rest of his body. But that part of his body had already swallowed some nectar. So that part of his body remained immortal. Not literally eternal, but like the nectar of the gods, give them great longevity. And so this Rahu, and detailed description in the purports there, Rahu is a planet. He has his residence, like the demigods have theirs, he has his residence in his own planet. Only it's an invisible planet, and this invisible planet Rahu has enmity and enviousness, particularly towards its nearby planet, the moon or Chandra's planet. And so, on different occasions, he attempts to devour Chandra, and this is what we call conventionally eclipses, where Rahu is trying to devour Chandra. Now, that sounds like really far out mythology, but how our devotees who are doing this planetarium project that I described to you the other day is going to be very interesting, because Rahu, by Vedic narration, is exactly this person. And predictably, Rahu's, which is an invisible planet causing an eclipse, the position of Rahu can be calculated. And at the time that the two will cross, of course, we know what modern science says. It's the shadow of the Earth casting a shadow on the moon that causes the eclipse. And they can calculate it their way, and the Vedas can calculate it their way. So now, us simple folks here in Andhra Pradesh, we can think about, do we want to take the Vedic authority or the other authority? The Vedic authority has a very precise method of calculation. In fact, next year, by Vedic calculation, there will be a full lunar eclipse on the night or the morning of Lord Chaitanya's appearance, Gaura Purnima, in India. Make note, at around 4:30 in the morning, something like 2:30 to 4:30 in the morning, all of India, whoever's awake, will be able to observe a full lunar eclipse on Gaura Purnima day, early morning. And that's calculated by Rahu, the position of Rahu, and Rahu is trying to devour or take over Chandra's planet. How to explain these two? I don't know if our planetarium project devotees are going to even try to say what Western astronomy says. They're just depicting what Vedic astronomy says. And it's very systematic and very precise, very accurate. One of the interesting things, one of the most interesting things, is the science of Vedic astronomy was generated without the use of technology at all. Meaning, they had no telescopes. They didn't send, what do you call those big ones? They send up on in a spacecraft and zoom around and take pictures. Huh? Yeah, but it said there's a particular... Huh? I can't hear. You're one at a time. Space shuttle. Yeah, there's a name. There's a particular one that takes pictures all the time. And they direct the craft to go near Mars and take pictures of Mars. And over there and take pictures over there. So, and then send it back by beaming signals, and then the scientists look at it and they can measure according to so many, you know, the colors of light and so many things, what distances are. And they're getting, through technology, they're getting very, very precise, accurate measurements of, at least by their system, of the structure of the universe. But there was no such thing as telescopes, no such thing as this system of beaming pictures from outer space back to the technologists in their space laboratories. So without technology, how do they have all this accurate information? You know, it's the wrong way to say it is the accuracy of the Vedas is now being demonstrated because modern science is saying the same thing that the Vedas are. You know, with all of their advanced technology, the match is practically one-to-one. But before their advanced technology, it was off by factors of 100 and several hundred, even things like the distance between the Earth and the Sun. By factors of several hundred, they had, you know, before Copernicus and before there were telescopes, very off. Then telescopes, then high-power telescopes, then, you know, super telescopes. I wish I could remember what they call those ones. And now the technology is to send the telescope and beam the signal back, pictures and pictures. Now it's much more refined. So what the Vedas said thousands of years ago, without technology, is now practically one-to-one matching what modern science through technology is saying. So the question is, where'd they get that information? Not through technology, not through the ascending process of sensory inspection, but rather through the descending method of sound vibration from higher authorities. So now comes the question, for such advanced systems of knowledge, with such precise and accurate, quantifiable, empiric measurements, are such elevated, learned persons going to just make up mythology to describe it? Does that make sense? It's not a proof, but does it make sense that they're going to have interest in just inventing stories? It doesn't make sense. This is another reason why this Vedic planetarium, or temple of Vedic planetarium, is so important. It gives confirming evidence that the Vedas are real. Sataputta wrote an article for Back to Godhead magazine. We'll come back to the Bhagavatam in just a moment. I forget the person's name, but a very British-sounding name, Bartholomew or something like that. There was a time when European scholars like the early 1800s. European scholars started developing an interest in the Sanskrit literatures of India. So by this time, Christianity was all over Eastern and Western Europe. One of the ways, back up a bit. Someone just sent me a connection to a website that shows chronologically how religions spread throughout the world. I'll give the link to you. And you can download the link and you can show it to your classes. And it shows historically how this religion and that religion and that religion spread. And then over a period of time, some of them shrunk and some of them expanded. So how religion expands, it gives a little bit of the history, but sometimes it's military, like, you know, the Christian Crusades and things like that. But sometimes it's just by ideology. So our presenting the ideology of Srimad Bhagavatam is very important. It's peaceful, but it's very important. And that people can explain it and strongly present it, clearly present it, very important. Distributing this knowledge profusely is very important. That people read the books and understand the books and live by the books is also important. But so, Christianity, by the early 1800s, had very clearly established its position in Europe. Some of the, particularly German and Dutch, and then eventually some British scholars, started developing some curiosity about the Sanskrit literature of India. And then they were acclaiming, oh, this is really deep. Let's go learn about the Sanskrit literature from India. The Christian intellectuals saw the pendulum moving this way, and they thought, we have to do something to move it that way. So they went on a campaign. Historically, there's certain persons, whatever the names were, all over Europe, claiming two things. That, you know, rubbish, mythology, who can believe in, you know, the Lord assumes the form of a tortoise and he's got a scratch on his back and he gets his scratch itched because this golden mountain is placed on his back and a giant serpent is the churning rod and the demons and the demi... And come on. Come on. Poison and nectar and Mohini Murti and... And... If that common sense doesn't convince you, these Vedas speak about two empiric things. Empiric means you can measure them. They're quantifiable. And one of them is the description of the dating of life when events took place, because there's numbers. Like so many, such and such year. So the knowledge of the origin of life, because the Christian Bible teaches one thing and the Vedic literature teaches another thing. So through the claim was through anthropology, very similar to what Charles Darwin said, as anthropology develops, we will find that the origin of species will be confirmed. It was a post-data check. And the other was the structure of the universe. It's empiric and quantifiable, and we will see through these two, as these two things evolve in science, anthropology and discovering of the origin of the species of life, the origin of man, and the variation of species of life, and through astronomical data. As science becomes more and more refined, these two quantifiable things within the Vedas will be proven as completely erroneous, pulling out the rug from all these mythology stories. That was the claim. Strong propaganda. And so these two features of work that Prabhupada wanted our scientists to do, one was what Sataputta and Dhrutakarma did with forbidden archaeology. In fact, as archaeology advanced, there's so much data that says what modern science has to say about the dating of mankind is bogus. So they just tucked that evidence somewhere else and hid it for Dhrutakarma to go and actually get the curators of museums to go in the back where they don't show things and find, whoa, there it is. And see it and inspect it physically. You know, there was reluctance. Sometimes you have to pay a little bakshish to get to see things like that. Because their reputation is at stake. The whole... Anyway, and then this other. So the Vedic planetarium, the work that... This work that that Dhrutakarma did a recent tour in India. I don't know if you're aware, but extensive tour and huge response from the intellectuals of India. Some, most, very much supportive. And others, you know, there wasn't a neutral response. It was very much in favor and very much against. Practically wherever he goes, it's, you know, he creates a stir. Because it's really solid evidence. As people, things that people just don't talk about and write about, but they know that it's valid evidence. And then the structure of the universe. So, you know, this is speaking about the position of the ocean of milk and things like that. I want to read what Prabhupada says in the purport about the ocean of milk. It's right on this topic. Purport. Although it is not our experience, there is a milk ocean within this universe. Even the modern scientist accepts that there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of planets hovering over our heads, and each of them has different climatic conditions. Srimad Bhagavatam gives much information which may not tally with our present experience. But as far as Indian sages are concerned, knowledge is received from Vedic literatures, and the authorities accept without any hesitation that we should look through the pages of authentic books of knowledge. Shastra Chakshurvat. So, we cannot deny the existence of the ocean of milk, as stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam, unless and until we have experimentally seen all the planets hovering in space, which isn't going to happen. Since such an experiment is not possible, naturally we have to accept the statement of Srimad Bhagavatam as it is, because it is so accepted by spiritual leaders like Sridhar Swami, Jiva Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and others. The Vedic process is to follow in the footsteps of great authorities, and that is the only process for knowing that which is beyond our imagination. So, it's for scholars, oversimplistic. For the devotees, it's the sensible thing to go. Am I going to follow Richard Dawkins, or am I going to follow Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Sridhar Swami, and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and Jiva Goswami? I don't have difficulty making that choice. We can't confirm or deny, is there an ocean of milk? The authorities of the Vedas say there's an ocean of milk. But we can make a choice. Reject it? Well, there's three choices. Accept it, or I don't know. And the knowing, we can say, yes, we don't, empirically we don't know. We can't say for sure. But that's not the way of knowing something like this. Rather, this was stated in the previous chapter, like 8 verses or so, that we can't know about the appearance of the Lord and his transcendental qualities and pastimes by empiric method. He's not knowable. The tiny cannot know the unlimited. The logic is very clear. But to the degree that there is submission and surrender and service and purification that comes to that degree, proportionate to that, one can know. New paragraph. The primeval Lord, being all-powerful, can do whatever he likes. And therefore his assuming the incarnation of a tortoise or a fish or for serving a particular purpose is not at all astonishing. Therefore, we should not have any hesitation whatsoever in accepting the statements of the authentic scriptures like Srimad Bhagavatam. Now that, to a rationalist, that's not compelling. To a devotee, it's compelling. And since the world began, there are these two natures, Sura and Asura. That's just how the world is. Krishna describes. And we can make a choice to be amongst the Sura or the Asura. And you say, I'm not sure. We put you in the other category. It's the default mode. New paragraph. The gigantic work of churning the milk ocean by the combined effort of the demigods and demons required a gigantic resting ground or pivot for the gigantic Mandara mountain hill. Thus, to help the attempts of the demigods and the primeval Lord assumed the incarnation of a gigantic tortoise swimming in the ocean of milk. At the same time, the mountain scratched his backbone as he was partially sleeping and thus relieved his itching sensation. End of purport. We can't do that. Huh? Well, the Lord can do that. And even having an itching sensation, you know, that's Leela. The whole thing is Leela. So the devotee doesn't go, how is that possible? The devotee is thinking, how wonderful is my Lord? And how do we know it's the Lord and not some imagination? It's the authority of Srimad Bhagavatam. Devotees would do well to read the first Sandarbha of Jiva Goswami at some point in time. It's called Pramana Kanda. I'll go through it quickly. The first, something like 14 verses, it's invocation. Invocation starts with the Ishtadev. Jiva Goswami describes the personality of Godhead, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He is my Lord and Master. He is my all in all. From him I understand whatever it is that I understand by his mercy. Then he glorifies Krishna in a few verses. Then he says, by the mercy of one Bhatta, that's Gopal Bhatta Goswami. Bhatta means a learned person, so Gopal Bhatta said, you have to promise, you can't put my name. So he says, by the mercy of one Bhatta, one insignificant jiva, was given the task of describing the glories of Krishna. Then he says, that's what I want to do. But before beginning the description of the glories of Krishna, let us consider the means by which we can know that which we want to glorify. Before we begin our glorification, how can you know that which it is that you want to glorify? End of section. Then he begins Pramana Kanda. What's the means by which you can know anything? And there's three standard anythings, three standard means of evidence. What are they? Pratyaksha, Anuman and Shabda. So he gives a list of 13 because he's Jiva Goswami. Actually, those 13 are but subdivisions of the first three. So you can group them as first three, but you know, scholarly, he breaks them apart. And then he goes through one by one by one by one and says, these are lesser. The best means of knowing something is by Shabda. Okay. What's the best Shabda? And he says, some people say the best Shabda is the Shrutis. Well, let's look at that. The Shrutis are so vast, and he goes through reasons why studying the Shrutis is very, very difficult. The Sanskrit is difficult. Their availability is much less. The disposition of people in this age to go through all of that is very, very little. Very difficult to discern. However, the Shrutis, which explain, the Smritis, which explain the Shrutis, are more accessible. They're present in their fullness. He describes that out of the total Shrutis that originally were there when Vyas divided the Vedas, in amongst those four Vedas, he calculates, and this was 500 years ago, it's less now, that there was something like ranging from 8 to 13% of each of those, the fullness of those Vedas presently available. So multiply it out. Supposing you wanted to understand Bhagavad Gita and you had 8 to 13% of the verses, and your task was to understand the message of Bhagavad Gita. Difficult task, wouldn't it? What to speak of if it's all chapter 1? To understand the purpose, it might be a little better if you had chapter 9 or chapter 7 or something, but if it's chapter 1, you got to get the purpose of the Vedas from that. Purpose of Bhagavad Gita. Very difficult. And then he gives the history, Baladeva Vidyavasan gives the history of how when the invasions came from the north and vast libraries were just burned, the books which were handwritten were used for cooking meat. The cows were slaughtered and the books were used for cooking the meat. Like, you know, insult after demolishing the temples and defacing the deities and burning the books. So the Vedas were largely gone, the treasure house of the Vedas. But the Smritis are largely intact. They're more accessible because the Sanskrit is simpler. And they're intended by the author to explain that which is difficult to understand. Then he goes through and says that according to the Shrutis, the Smritis are as Vedic as the Shrutis. He gives specific verses from the Shrutis. So modern scholarship says that's Vedic and this is not Vedic. It's modern and not to be accepted. Scholars say that, but the Shrutis themselves say no. The Smritis are as Vedic as we are. So you have your choice. Something that's very little. Anyway, the arguments have been made. So therefore, the Smritis are better. Okay, and then out of the Smritis, what's best? Then he says, everyone knows, and in Bhagavad Gita it's clearly declared, the mode of goodness amongst the three modes of nature is best. And so the Puranas are also divided into these three. Goodness, passion. So those in the mode of goodness are best. And of those in the mode of goodness, the Srimad Bhagavatam is best. So, and then he goes through the glories of Srimad Bhagavatam and then says, okay. So we want to talk about Krishna. To talk about Krishna or anything, because everything comes from Krishna, we need the reference of Srimad Bhagavatam. That's our final authority. Okay, now we're going to talk about Krishna. That's a really quick version. You can give a seminar on study Tattva Sandarbha for a month. I just gave you a quick. And the way that Jiva Goswami does it, it's just brilliant. Powerful. So, We take the authority of Srimad Bhagavatam beyond the authority of the senses of the scientists or the reasoning capacity of the scientists or any other person, for that matter. We take the authority of Shabda. And amongst the Shabda Srimad Bhagavatam, the Srimad Bhagavatam declares, with careful reasoning, we are taking the authority of Srimad Bhagavatam, not just blindly, with careful consideration. The authority of Srimad Bhagavatam. Lord Kurma has an itch. He wants to get his itch scratched. So he performs a leela. And he's accepting service from the demons and the demigods and doing it. And he's doing many things at one time. He's protecting the demigods. So after this Mohini Murti scene and she gives the nectar to the demigods, then another battle erupts. They pick up their weapons and the demons are fighting the demigods. Whole chapter, battle scene. Beautiful paintings depicting the battle between the demigods and the demons. Lord Vishnu appears on the battlefield, descending on Garuda and destroys the rest of the demons that haven't already been killed. The demons are destroyed. The demigods regain their kingdom. Until Indra makes his next mistake. Then there's the whole chapter of Mohini Murti bewilders even Lord Shiva, which connects with what we've been studying in the previous verses here. It was mentioned that maybe it wasn't mentioned. Narayan Rishi did not become disturbed by Kandarpa. And here, in this Leela, Mohini Murti disturbs Lord Shiva. He becomes attracted to Mohini Murti's beauty. And that's natural because Mohini Murti is the personality of Godhead, but appearing in this all-attractive female form. So, we only covered one verse, but there's a lot. I think there'll be some inspiration when you go through at some point in time in the cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam, the pastimes of the Lord, to read them with ever greater relish. Again, that the message preceding this chapter is just by hearing these messages. It's not, you know, the point is to try to understand the Lord's pastime, but rather to hear the Lord's pastime, to hear in a submissive manner with great appreciation of the Lord's transcendental potencies. And purification is taking place in the heart just by hearing. The mind is going to the Lord instead of whatever else is going on in the world today. And this is our Vedic way of life. In the evening, persons would come together, Prabhupada taught. Instead of going to the cinema and the nightclub and whatever else people do, hang out in the corner and blah, 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 or in front of the television set, they would gather together just as we're doing and hear the wonderful descriptions of the personality of Godhead. Of course, hear them again and again and hear them in great detail. Srimad Bhagavatam provides that. It purifies the soul. And the mind then becomes attracted to thoughts of the Supreme Lord. Ajita, personality of Godhead, appeared and assumed the form of a tortoise to assist the demigods to regain their kingdom. And in the process, so many things were produced by the Lord's plan. Okay, so any comments or questions?
Yes.
From Jiva Goswami's arguments, the Shrutis are practically impossible to be understood in the Kaliya. Then why did Vyasadeva at all compile them? Considering that he had done the task specifically for considering Kaliya.
That's a common question. Why didn't he just compile the devotional literatures and skip it? You know, why all this other stuff that might confuse people? And the answer is that they're recognizing that they're all different types of modes of nature, and you know, if you gave only one option, surrender to the personality of Godhead, those persons that are not prepared to surrender to the personality of Godhead, what's to become of them? And there's a lot of such people, because the material world is made up of individuals who have rebelled from the personality of Godhead. And there's only one option, and there's no other options. So for such people, the vast majority of other people, a system of indirect, gradual elevation. Because in those other Vedas, there's all this, just primarily the Karmakanda understandings and ways of achieving things that one desires on the authority of the Vedas. So the wish then is that one can accept the authority of the Vedas and thereby accept the authority of the personality of Godhead, although indirectly. And one is encouraged to do so because I'm going to get something that I want, like enjoyment, or scholars, knowledge, jnana and karma. So it's there for those people. Okay, here's a question. Small handwriting. How to successfully distribute Prabhupada's something to your satisfaction? Some suggestions we should attend to while we are doing the service. How best we can do this? People are so much interested in reading, are not so much interested in reading Vedic literature. And they also have lots of unbona fide books and feel satisfied with them. I guess the word is books. How to successfully distribute Prabhupada's books? Well, two things. Prabhupada said, people are mad after reading my books because they're coming from the position of realization. So if people get some literature and a chance to read what Prabhupada has written, they'll become very inspired. There's some recent things that I can't recall the detail right now. Recent things that I heard. Some persons that had, you know, a negative impression of organized religion in general and therefore also of Hare Krishna movement, ISKCON. And so they kept their distance. But something happened and they started reading some of the literature and they understood. This is really exceptional. There were two stories. One of them was someone from here in India and just, you know, kind of a no particular commitment to anything kind of a person. And another was from another culture altogether. And, you know, very different positions. But just specifically from reading Prabhupada's books, they could understand. This is very, very amazing. Someone was another religion, not just another culture. They're a follower of another religion. And they so much appreciate what Prabhupada has written. So if we can somehow give persons the opportunity just to receive the literature, and they get a chance to read. Sometimes even our book distributors do this. It's not like a practice that one would want to do, but all in all circumstances. But just read some phrases that are just really profound. Very simple statements, but very profound. Thought-provoking. A second point is, Prabhupada said, as far as technique to induce people, Prabhupada said, simply speak on the merit of the book. If you find out that somebody is interested in something, you in the course of getting to know somebody, or on book distribution, if you can get a sense of what it is that they have interest in, then you can focus the conversation upon that portion of the Vedas or Prabhupada's books which deals with that which they're interested in. And just present the merit of the book on that subject that they're interested in. And they find it fascinating. The Vedic perspective on whatever it is. A social interest or economic interest, or they're interested in yoga, or they're interested in something or something or something. And there is, the Vedic picture is very complete. So Prabhupada's statement was, sell the books on their own merit. He said, there's no, whatever glorification you make of Krishna, there's no exaggeration. Because his glories are unlimited. Someone is interested in something, glorify Krishna about that something. You're interested in wealth? Krishna, look at the opulence of Krishna. And it's described here. You're interested in warfare? You're interested in whatever you're interested in. Knowledge. Sankhya philosophy is so deep. You're interested in yoga. You're interested in meditation. You're interested in mystic powers. You're interested in uniting the religious views of the world. You know, whatever. What are you interested in? And then speak on that from Prabhupada's books, and even show them where it describes this. So if you're familiar with the books, you can do that. Another thing that book distributors find is very effective is the pictures often sell the books. They show the pictures, and as they're looking at the pictures, you're describing something, and a few pictures and you close the book, so take it home and read it. How much? Yes.
Chanting during the eclipse time have a magnifying effect?
Sure.
What is the reason?
I don't know the reason. Auspicious. They're like, you know, auspicious. It is said that during a solar eclipse is inauspicious, and a lunar eclipse is auspicious. So when there's a solar eclipse, you're not to look at the sun, but to go take bath in the Ganges and chant the holy name. Because it's inauspicious. So bathe in the Ganges. And that happened during one of our GBC meetings. There was a partial solar eclipse. So we went to the Ganges and chanted Hare Krishna. And if there's a lunar eclipse, you go to the Ganges and chant Hare Krishna. Because it's auspicious. And if there's no eclipse, you chant Hare Krishna. It's transcendental. The reason why it's particularly auspicious, I don't know. It's an auspicious configuration of planets. I don't know astronomy enough to say why it's auspicious. Yes. Oh, there's vanilla, there's strawberry, there's chocolate. Different flavors. The purification through difficulty generally comes because we're attached. One who is not attached, it's not a difficulty. Now we can become relieved from difficulty by the positive process of hearing and chanting. But those areas that we hold on to, because they're, we strongly identify with them as the source of happiness, that's where the pain comes. So a thoughtful person would let go of those things. And the rest of us hold on to those things and have to experience some pain. Okay. The Avanti Brahmana story discusses this in detail. Suffering is within the mind. Because of attachment.
Can we say that as a modern sense, it becomes more and more refined, then Vedic authority will be proved more and more?
We which more and more?
If modern sense becomes more refined, then Vedic authority, astrology, Vedic astrology, will be proved more.
Yeah. Well, except where one's faith lies. The modern science will just pump up their faith in science, not in the Vedas. You know, so the same event is seen by different ways, opposite ways, by the Asuras and the Asuras. That's just the way of life. Anything else? Okay. Yes?
Maharaj, very like this class, I mean that hearing is perfection, it is perfecting our material existence. So, mind goes on planning that how many pranks and relates they are suffering, and it goes for planning. So I find that my hearing is getting disturbed. I am not really able to make that more than hearing. Mind goes, how can I help them? I don't have planning, it comes.
I got it.
Undesirably, how to overcome this?
Hit the delete button. It takes purification, because the mind planning to help some people, that's fruitive activity. It's the mentality of a fruitive worker. One in the mode of passion. Kartaham iti manyate. It's not how, It's not the platform of one who's identifying with the soul and Krishna. So it's just a long-standing, unlimited numbers of lifetimes and years together that we've been doing that program. So it's going to, like the blades of a fan, it's going to continue to spin for a while. Just don't invest consciousness in the spinning blades of the fan. That residual tendency, just recognize it for what it is. It's just a continuation of long-standing habit. It's not me, and it's not the direction of the Vedas. So I'm just not going to pay attention. You just neglect it or hit the delete button. Don't let it disturb you. Just don't identify with it. And practice going down the untraveled path of surrendering to Krishna, depending upon Krishna, trying to serve Krishna, accepting direction from Krishna, accepting direction from those who represent Krishna, serving in that way with great faith and confidence. It's an untraveled, least of recent times, an untraveled path. And so it's a little more difficult to go down that road, because there's no road, it's just forest. And over there, there's a well-traveled road, and it's all downhill. Just get in your bicycle and go for a ride. Downhill. Until you realize, oh, it's not nice down there. Then you get go pedal back up again and make so. Back to Satyavrata's question, you know, there's different ways of purification. So take up the path of sadhana bhakti very seriously. That's one of the how-tos. Purify consciousness. And then when attachments bring rise to suffering, accept that is also needed purification. Well, I don't like the suffering part, I like the purification part. Because ultimately it's going to free me from this long-standing conditioning of being a so-called independent controller. It's a joke. It's a big mistake. And I want to stop making such a foolish mistake. Put on the brakes. Hit the delete button. Go down the path that you know from scriptural authority is the right path to go. And go in the association of other devotees. Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki.